Where are you?
Oh, I'm here in Los Feliz.
Oh, right on. That's my old neighborhood.
Yeah, where are you at?
I'm in Barcelona.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, man.
For good?
I don't know yet, man. I mean, we're gonna figure it out. We're trying to figure it out. You
Right.
know, we're trying to figure out like what's gonna be easier, like her coming to the States, me staying here,
Yeah.
you know, and then figure out comedy. You know, comedy's like, it's not just a job for me. It's like how I stay sane.
I
Like I
know.
told her, if I ever quit comedy, she wouldn't recognize me.
Yeah.
You know, so but
Anyway.
she's a huge comedy fan. She's got a fucking Mel Brooks tattoo on her forearm. So
Well, that's a keeper.
I, yeah.
Anyway, I'm recording now, so welcome to the
Okay,
lighter side of the
cool.
dark side. Welcome to the
Right
lighter
on. I
side of the
love that
dark
name,
side.
man. That's
He
a
keeps
great
interrupting
name.
me. Welcome to the lighter side of the dark side. It's your weekly freak show here on Renegade Radio, also on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. It's the Dark Mark Show. I'm Dark Mark, the goth comedian, and my co-host, everybody's favorite vegan heavy metal DJ, Hannah Bach. Hopefully, will be joining us. I'm not sure. She did tell me she took a mistakenly took a Tylenol PM instead of a Tylenol. So hopefully she'll be waking up any second now. But
It's amazing.
yeah, it's but she I asked Hannah, I said, who do you want to have as the first guest of the show? Because we just had our big Christmas show with Santa Claus and Rotten Kitty Maggie Mayfield, and we did our top 10. It's on YouTube, our top 10 moments of 2020. She said, how about somebody who makes me laugh? How about somebody brings joy for 2021? Starts off the year off right. So I was like, who's the funniest guy I know? Who's the first person I know? I knew I was going to say that. I meant person because I thought of quite a few ladies. And then this guy won the World Series of Comedy. He won the Portland Comedy Festival, beating a lot of really good comics, including myself. And I also has a he's won several festivals. He's been on True TV. He had a podcast with his mother, and he has a YouTube show now with his new wife, and we're going to talk about that. Very, very funny guy, Tamer Kitan.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I'm stoked to be on. I love the name, by the way. It's sick. I love it.
What's that?
Lighter side of the dark side? Is that what it
Yes,
is? That's
that's
a
always been
great
my
name.
my philosophy, the lighter side of the dark side.
I like that a lot.
Now, I've always called you Tamer, and you've always been introduced as Tamer. Is it Tamer? Is
No,
it
it's Tamer. You said it right. I
it's
always say
Tamer? Okay,
like a hammer with a T.
right,
Do you
because
know what's funny about you saying Tamer though? Is that I once performed in Paris and ta mère in French means your mother.
right.
So like I was introduced as like, hey, the next comedian is your mother.
Very nice.
Like, so weird that that was my name in French.
Did you have some good Tamer jokes in France or?
Well, I kind of found out about it when I was on
Yeah.
stage, and the comic after me, his name was Nick, and Nick is like F. Like, can we cuss on here?
I
Oh,
encourage
okay. Okay, yeah. So this other comic's name was Nick. So when you say Nick ta mère, it's like fuck your mother. Like
Nice.
one of the two of us. So they kept taking pictures with the two of us and standing in between us, and it was like the Nick ta mère photo photo op.
Now, did you do comedy in English or French?
Yeah, no, in English. It was an English-speaking comedy club called Panem. It was
Wow.
in Paris, yeah. I got a
That's
buddy
probably.
named Noman Hosni who now lives in LA. He's like a big YouTube guy and a great comic. He's like a pothead comic and he's great.
Yeah.
So he hooked me up out there.
That's cool. Anyway, so before we get started, and we've got all sorts of stuff to talk about, including the comedy clubs in Europe and everything else. With a
Sure.
comedy club that it was probably the name of the comedy club was up your ass or something. Who knows what that meant. But we got a couple sponsors real quick. We're sponsored by Audible.
Right on.
And you travel a lot, so you listen to audiobooks.
All the time. Yeah,
If
I'm
you
on Audible constantly.
go to audibletrial.com/DMS, audibletrial.com/DMS, it's the new year. I got new stuff for you. I got it's you get a free book. And now they have most of the Audible originals are free as well. You don't just get two, you get a bunch of them. You can get the play by Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live. You can get Bob Newhart interviewing other comics. You can get the Alien 3. William Gibson wrote an alternate script for Alien 3. They acted that out. Whatever you want, and any book that you want. You can even get The Stand by Stephen King, which is one of the best sellers 47 hours.
Wow.
Because it's a whole miniseries. You get that free. Wow. They got everything from Shakespeare to smut. So, and lots of books on comedy. They have a lot of Kevin Hart's autobiography. I know we were talking about him on another podcast. But go to audibletrial.com/DMS, free. And you can cancel the next day. You keep the books. But I bet you don't, because you get deep discounts if you stay. We're also sponsored by Doomy's Home Cooking. Please keep your restaurants alive. Doomy's Home Cooking. Now you're in great shape, but I might have asked you this in Portland, but are you vegan?
No, I'm not. I love meat.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. You'd love Doomy's Home Cooking, even though it's a vegan restaurant. Because they've got – this will be a cheat day, because I know you work out and you very, very – you watch your weight. This will be a cheat day. But if you're having a cheat day, have a pulled pork sandwich.
Right on.
Have a shrimp po' boy. Have some chicken flautas. Biggest chicken flautas you ever had. All vegan. If I put it in front of you, you'd be like, that was great. Delicious. And it's no meat anywhere. The ranch dressing is a secret recipe. They have desserts by Das Baker. It's a goth-themed vegan restaurant.
Right on. That's cool.
On 1253 Vine Street in Hollywood, California. For our LA people, definitely go down there. Now you have to take the stuff out, but do what you can. And also there's one in Culver City and one in Toronto, Canada. I'm actually going to leave for a second because I forgot to bring – I hope the green screen doesn't fall down, but I forgot to bring my other sponsor. Give me a second.
Sure.
Here it goes. Here goes the microphone. Hold on. Just take 1 second. I'm going to
– Sure.
There we go. Hold on. There it is, Raise Energy Drink. My favorite energy drink, and if people know me. Yeah, get on the mic. If people know me, they know I love energy drinks. And this is the best. You've probably seen this at the gym, at GNC.
Raise
Energy Drink. The best tasting, and also zero calories, zero carbs, zero crash. If you're listening to us on a podcast catcher or watching this on YouTube, there's a code where you get 15% off a case of Rays.
Nice. And
it'll keep you up for days.
I like it. It's a good name.
Delicious. Rays. That's actually Phantom Freeze. Really good. Anyway, so that's enough corporate chilling. I've got Tamara Catan. I was trying to think when I met you for the first time, and I have no idea. There it goes. I knew it was going. There goes the green screen. But I was trying to think when I met you for the first time, and as I get the green screen back. But, I mean, you've always been around, and you've been a great comic for years.
Thanks, man.
But you're Egyptian. You were born in Egypt.
Yeah, I was born in Egypt, yeah. We moved to the States when I was 8 years.
I don't know any other city in Egypt, just Cairo.
Yeah, good guess. I mean, I was born in Cairo, and then we moved to Alexandria. We were back and forth between those two cities. And then we moved to the States when I was 8.
Hold on 1 second.
This is great. I love it.
Anyway, so let me fall down all night. Anyway, so let me get back to the conversation here.
Sure.
Well, next week we'll have that fixed. So, but you were the funniest thing about you is you were born to a Muslim father and a Jewish mother.
Yeah, man, it was weird. Yeah.
So basically, them having sex and giving birth to you.
Yeah.
It's the solution to the Middle East crisis.
You'd think.
You would. Think.
Yeah. It's true.
If only anybody took lessons from your parents.
Yeah, man. I mean, I think they're a great example of, you know, it's not only that they got married and were opposite religions. They got married and they were super happy. Like my dad wasn't the greatest dad, but he was a great husband. And they loved the shit out of each other. And they were great partners for each other. And they just didn't listen to all the bullshit from people trying to divide us all the time. You know, they weren't brainwashed by that nonsense. And
are you saying in the Middle East there were people that did not want them to be together?
Oh, dude, it was madness. The first time somebody ever used a racial slur towards me was when I was in my mother's womb. Like I was experiencing racism. The first time I heard racism was through a belly button hole.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Do you remember the racial slur? I'm just trying to figure.
No, out. I was a baby. I think I still had a tail at the time, so I don't remember the exact phrase. But like, my own relatives. I had relatives that didn't want to know me, you know, because they said, oh, you know, you're marrying a Muslim to my mom, you know, so we don't want to meet the kid. And then they would say stuff like, oh, we'll meet him. And on my dad's side too. And they were like, oh, we'll meet him after you guys get divorced. Things like that. It was really fucked up. But you know what it's like when people try to push you against or push you away from someone you love, it usually makes that bond tighter. So I think it brought them closer together. It was, they were very much had like a Bonnie and Clyde dynamic, you know?
It depends on the bond though. I mean, I think there's some couples that couldn't take abuse like that.
And, yeah, that's true.
Your parents could.
Yeah, that's true. I think it does strengthen it if there's the two of you against something bigger, you know.
Because I know just friends of mine that have been in interracial relationships. Yeah. I've dated out of my race and seen the stares and things like that. But yeah, I mean, it shows that they have a great bond. And the other thing that's and you mentioned this on a podcast, and I didn't really think about it, but it's true. They say that if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish.
Yeah.
And if your father's Muslim, you're Muslim.
Yeah.
So what the hell are you?
Exactly. I'm an atheist.
Yes. Yes. Well, there you go.
Yeah, man. It's crazy. Like it shows you how ridiculous some religions can be, you know, like according to their rules, there's no reason I should exist. You know, like I break the rules. So it's they just thought there was no way that those two types of people could ever meet. So I literally break the rules just by existing. I break the religions by existing.
And I know all I know about your father is kind of from your act. And honestly, yeah. Even though I have a better relationship with my father, it sounds like they would kind of get along, just both kind of alpha male sort of guys. But yeah. Your mother, she was on, you actually did a podcast with her at an old studio comedy pop-up called They Tried to Bury Us.
Yeah.
And I also saw her on your acting reel. You guys were on a reality show where she was trying to set you up.
Yeah.
She's a bit of a ham.
She's hilarious, man. She's super funny. And it's funny too, because I feel like, you know how comics are kind of people that were like, you know, bullied or picked on when they were kids. And then when they get on stage, they kind of become a bigger version of themselves and they find their comedic voice. Sure. I think that's what happened to my mom. Like when she was in Egypt, she had to stay quiet and she couldn't have a big personality. She couldn't crack jokes all the time. I mean, she could in our house, but on the street, she had to be like, pretty reserved and afraid of what people would do if they found out she was a Jew living in Egypt, you know?
Right.
So I think when we got to America, the caterpillar became a butterfly, you know?
but was this always? I mean, was this after, is she envious a bit of you being able to go on up in front of crowds? And
no, dude, she transcends, man. She is beyond a human. She's just like, she's unconditional love. Totally. Yeah. She's such a, she's my number one fan. She's like she's the best. I'm really, really lucky.
But would she ever like maybe try to have a go at it at a comedy or no?
Nah, she's not about it. I mean, she's great. I think she's super fun. She was a great co-host on the podcast. She's super funny. When I was on that TV show, she was just, she's fantastic. But her whole thing is just, you know, supporting me. Which is awesome. But I mean, if she wanted to do it, I'm all for it. I think she's great.
My mother's too shy to do it. She would never, it never even would occur to her. And if I had her on a podcast, if I was doing a podcast like this with her as a co-host, like every 2 minutes, it would just be like, Mark, why are you saying things like that? But your mother's just the opposite. You got to calm her down.
Totally. She's always been super liberal. Like when we got to the States, man, like, her first best friend was a gay guy named Bob who had HIV and owned a flower shop. And that was her best friend. And so at a really early age, I was being introduced. She's like, Tamara, this is my friend. He's gay. And that's why he acts different. And gay people are the same as straight people. And she was just all about it. You know, she didn't want me to be too much like my pop. Like she wanted me to be a kinder version of my pop. And but she wasn't mad at my dad and she didn't judge him. She just knew that he went through some heavy shit when he was a kid. And she just wanted me to be a more empathetic person, you know? Right. And so I was friends with gay people at a very early age and friends with trans people. I knew trans people before trans people were all over TV and stuff, just because my mom was sort of like a mother to so many different kinds of people that kind of needed a mom, you know? And if you listen to the podcast, you'll see there's some pretty dark moments on the podcast where we're talking to people about what it was like to immigrate from like Ukraine or from Moldova or, you know, Iran and Mexico. And there's moments where people are talking about really heavy stuff. My mom interrupted like this boxer, this really gnarly looking boxer that had tattoos from head to fingertips, you know? And she goes, "Can I hug you?" Like in the middle of this really dark story. And it was exactly what the moment needed. And, you know, and it, he just turned into a big brownie right after she gave him a hug. He just melted, you know?
Yeah.
So she's rad.
No, that's why I should explain is the podcast is you with a different guest from everyone from a different country that's immigrated to the United States.
Exactly. I mean, my mom and I have been here since we were kids. My mom, you know, loves America and she's such a patriot, you know, and so she's never had any problems here and she's a big personality and fun and we've never had problems with anybody. And then I think like when the, you know, the real divisiveness and nastiness started happening in this last presidential time, like a lot of racist behavior started coming out towards her, a lot of really negative treatment. And as a comic, I'm like, I gotta be constructive about this and not go down a dark route and do ugly things. So I'm like, hey, let's make a podcast and just show people what real immigrants are like instead of, and how real immigrants are the American story. You know, like everything you saw on TV was shithole countries this and desperate people that, but I wanted to show people the story. You know, it was basically a really, really simple podcast. Every episode was three acts. What was your home country like and why did you come to America? What's been the toughest part? And we always ended on a positive. What's been the best part of being here? Yeah. And it was great. We had some amazing stories. I didn't even realize how many immigrants I knew, but we did it for a long time until I moved. And, you know, so of course it's a little bit tougher to do together now.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, with the Zoom, it's kind of, what's been good about the Zoom is I interviewed somebody in Germany, Thailand, you're in Spain now. So it's brought the world closer together, but especially today, I don't want to get on a political rant, but
yeah, no worries. I get it. Yeah we're all
but,
tired.
But you know, what's great about that is you're showing if people listen to somebody's experience and somebody's story, it humanizes it.
100%. That's exactly
everybody
right.
Everybody can relate to it. Everybody struggles in their own way.
Yeah, man. And dude, I grew up punk rock. I've been a fan of punk rock music since I was a kid. And and the last few years have made me realize that I was right when I was in eighth grade. Like I had a t-shirt with a fork and knife through it and it said, "Eat the rich." And my dad used to get so angry at that. You know, he was like, "Oh, it's bad to make money. Is that right?" But it was just, no, it wasn't about that kind of rich. It was about people so rich that they could manipulate governments and stuff. And so when I was a kid, I just knew instinctively that, you know, really, really powerful people are dangerous and they're not on our side, you know? So I grew up listening to punk rock
I was gonna really get into that because I know you're heavily tatted. When we were in Portland, you were showing me your Misfits shirt and everything else. But so you got to America, you were like 8 years old. 8 years old with a big afro, which if you're looking at it now,
yeah, dude, YouTube, I missed that.
Kind of hard
hair.
To believe.
Yeah. I look ridiculous with an afro. I probably look like Mr. Cotter from Welcome Back, Carter. If I had a mustache
with the afro, you look exactly like him. and he's Jewish, so there you go.
You're right.
Yeah, speaking of that, I know that you rail against the white Jesus on something I saw of yours. Uh-huh. And here's the thing, but when black people say Jesus was black, that's not exactly accurate either.
Yeah.
Jesus was Israeli, and if you see Israelis,
sure.
They look like me. You know, they look like Egyptians. They look like Iranians. They look like it's a whole Middle East kind of thing. So
totally.
He wasn't, to me, if he existed at all, he wasn't white and he wasn't black.
Yeah.
He didn't look like Chris Cornell and he didn't look like Snoop Dogg. He looked more like Osama bin Laden than either one of them.
Totally. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Weather changes people. That's what we know for sure. If you live in a certain area based on weather, you could totally predict how someone's going to look. Weather is what makes us look different from each other. That's it, not anything else. And so if we know where he's born, Egypt, and we knew where he grew up in Israel, then we know he probably, his skin color and coloring probably looked a hell of a lot more like me than, you know, than the Jesus that they put up on pictures in Utah.
Basically what I'm saying is Tamer Katan is Jesus. That's what that's what I'm saying. But so you got to America and you were bullied.
Yeah.
You were in LA, right?
Yeah, when we first moved, we went straight to East LA, because it was, you know, we couldn't afford to live in a nicer part of town, and East LA was rough in the 80s, 70s and 80s, yeah.
Did you ever, I know this is a weird question, but did you ever try to pass yourself off as Mexican?
Yeah, you know, the Mexican kids actually embraced me. They were cool with it. You know, they thought, like, I had this joke that I used to say that, you know, when you get to elementary school, when recess happens, it's like a prison. All these miniature gangs start to form in the yard, you know, all by race too.
Absolutely.
And
then
so Mexican kids kind of, you know, they're like, hey, you're Egyptian, we're Mexican, you got pyramids, we got pyramids, come hang out with us. And so there was even a time where I was going to join a Mexican gang just because the neighborhood I was in. Yeah. I mean, they were cool to me. They, you know, and I was cool to them. And it wasn't because I wanted to hurt anybody. It was, or that I felt in danger, really. It was just because I was an only child, and all of a sudden, and I was surrounded by family in Egypt, and now we're in East LA. Both my parents worked two jobs. I never saw them. I was always alone. And then all of a sudden I had these kids saying, hey, come hang out with our family. This is a family. So it was like, being in a gang was like, I was being recruited as if I was being recruited into a cult. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
Sorry, my neighbors. I don't know if that's on the mic. But no, it's, no, I know exactly what you mean. But I would think being in East LA, not a lot of Egyptians, so you kind of go with the flow. It reminds me when I was in jail, because I was in jail for a couple of days because of a traffic thing, and everybody segregated, and I was in a cell with probably 50 black people, 50 Latin people, and me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, where do I go? And they didn't really have an answer. And then the Mexican population let me use the phone. I was kind of there by default, I guess. But so I can relate to that. But you said it was about the 80s, so you bonded with them listening to the Smiths, I'm sure. And
no, I was more into heavier stuff, but yeah, I used to make fun of some of the guys that listened to it. Yeah, it was a trip.
Yeah, no, some of the most hardcore vatos, man, they love that Morrissey.
Yeah, dude, it's wild. I used to ask them about that. I'm like, what is it with you guys and Morrissey? And especially some of the kids that like just moved here from Mexico.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's up with Morrissey? And they're like, oh, dude, it's because, you know, in Mexico, when they play mariachi music is about lost love. And if it's not about lost love, it's not mariachi. He's like, so when he got to America and we listened to Western music, there was nothing like that until we heard Morrissey. And then we're like,
I've
oh my God.
I've heard that explanation before, yeah.
Yeah, so it was a trip, dude. There's even a really great band called Mexicacy, and they sing Morrissey songs in Spanish. Right. They're awesome too. They're so good.
Right. And then Morrissey opened for Jaguares at the Forum once. And
oh wow, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he had a whole tour. Viva Esteban.
That's rad. Yeah, but Mexicans are dope.
Before your mustache threw me, you did have kind of when you were clean shaven with the bald head, you kind of had a racially ambiguous Vin Diesel rock sort of thing happening.
Yeah.
So you can pass for pretty much anything.
Yeah, dude. That's the thing that's so funny is like, I feel like I'm pretty lucky that way. At least when if I'm traveling, whatever, in almost any country I've been in, it's pretty, I don't usually get too much shit, you know? Like I remember I was in the south of France one time when I used to work in advertising, and during the day I was in a suit, you know, for this big, it was at the Cannes Advertising Awards. It wasn't film. It was like the week after. It was for advertising. Okay. And I was in this hotel in Nice. And as we're, you know, we decided after the festival to spend some time in France. And I went to Nice and I was going to go see a French band play Beatles music. And I heard it was dope because they sing Beatles songs, but with French accents. Right. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to check this out. So when I was in my suit, I went up to the guy at the hotel and I'm like, hey, do you know how to get to Old Town? niece from here. He goes, oh yeah. You know, he starts giving me directions and he goes, yeah, there's a stairway that you see. And you, it's literally like an underground part of the city. And he goes, but you know, sir, please be careful. It's dangerous there. And you know, there's a lot of pickpockets and criminals and stuff. And I was in a suit, you know? So I'm like, okay. So I go upstairs, I change, and then I'm in my jeans and a t-shirt and you know, the tattoos, yeah, I'm sleeved. And I start walking through the streets and I get to Nice and I hear these kids start yelling something at me in French. And I'm like, what'd you say? And they're like, something, something, you know, marijuana. And I was like, oh no, I don't want to buy any weed. And they're like, no. Do you sell weed?
Oh, that's like a weed dealer.
Yeah, man. So here he was trying to protect me from the criminals. And as soon as I got into the street, they thought I was one of them. Cause like all the people in the street were avoiding me in France. And I realized that in France, it's the Middle Eastern looking kids that are like the Black and Mexican kids of that country.
Okay.
Like those are the kids that get in trouble. The kids that are North African who go to France, those are the kids that are selling drugs and getting in trouble and stuff. So when I was walking down the street, people were kind of moving away from me and stuff. And I was like, whoa, this is weird.
That's great. Yeah, now, how wild is the Cannes Advertising Festival? So we've seen the Cannes Film Festival and there's nude women on the beach and it's wild. How yeah, wild do the advertisers get? Is it even worse or what?
It was weird for me, you know, like I was in advertising, but I didn't want to be in it, you know, right. Like it was like, to me, I felt like advertising was safe. Like I always wanted to be a writer and I always wanted to get into comedy. And so even though I was writing funny commercials and it was really cool to be at Cannes, like I thought that was, you know, it's kind of like the Super Bowl for advertising. So I felt like really lucky that I got to go there. You know, when I was part of an agency that had like 500 people and to be one of six they got to go was cool. So I was stoked to be there. And yeah, you do, you feel proud, you know, you feel a little bit puffed up and a little bit confident, you know, in yourself, but at the same time, I didn't look at them and think like, oh, I want to be like those guys. You know,
so I was like a dog out there trying to buy advertising.
Nah, I was like a dog that barked at other dogs. You know what I mean? I was like, I know I'm one of you, but I don't want to be.
Was there any commercial that you wrote that we would know?
I mean, I was part of teams that wrote a lot of stuff. I mean, I worked on Apple and Nissan, Gatorade, Visa, a lot of stuff. So I've worked on some pretty big stuff as part of a team though. But yeah, like when I was at Deutsch, we did the Volkswagen ad with a little kid for Darth Vader.
Yeah,
that was a big spot for us. We did, it was like probably one of the first Super Bowl things I did. And then I did a bunch of stuff for Apple. Especially for iTunes. I did stuff for Samsung with Jay-Z. The Jay-Z album came out and they did like a collab with him. So yeah, I've been really lucky. I've gotten to work on some really cool stuff.
That's cool. Now let's go back. Now I say you're a curly haired 8-year old.
Yeah.
That's getting, you're getting gang interest. Now, how did you end up discovering punk rock? And how do you define punk rock?
Well, it's funny because I don't know if you could tell, but I have a scar right here,
okay,
next to my eye.
I can see it now, yeah.
Right there, and right there. I got bit by a dog when I was a kid, and I had to wear like an eye patch for a while. And these kids made fun of me, and they kept calling me a pirate and all this shit. So I'd go to the library to stay away from the bullies, and I'd sit in the library, and I read every book I could about pirates. And then at the end, you know, I was like, oh, there's no more books. So I started reading adult books about pirates. And then the adult books about pirates were the truth.
Right.
And they were like, oh, these guys weren't bad guys. They were actually soldiers returning from war. And that's why they had peg legs and hook hands.
True.
They were injured. They were war veterans. And it was England that told them, we don't have jobs for you now that you're back from war and risked your life for us. So they were like, of course, pissed off. And so they had bylaws and they had rules that they followed. They weren't bad people. And so I've started reading about these guys and I'm like, wow, these guys are actually good guys, but everybody talks about them like they're bad guys. And I'm like, oh, that's me. That's what I'm like. And so I embraced being called a pirate. And all of a sudden, when I was watching movies, I'd root for the Indian instead of the cowboy. I'd root for the robbers instead of the cops.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at the time, like, you know, punk rock just fell into my lap. I discovered Suicidal Tendencies, which was an amazing band. And I had a lot of frustration, you know, so I was an abused kid. So I had a lot of pent up anger. So I think, you know, when I saw like mosh pits and stuff, the I mean, I looked at mosh pits the way my cat looks at a scratching post. I'm like, ooh, I can get out a lot of anxiety in that thing. And so I fell in love with it. And I got a catalog in Hollywood called War Babies. That's where I bought all my clothes. Okay. And it was a catalog that you could buy, and you could buy like bondage pants and like creepers and it was dope, man. So I started finding my style, finding my voice. And it was, you know, I felt like that was me becoming me, like when I found punk rock.
Right. Your parents wouldn't get you a Pepsi and you just went crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, here's the weird thing about mosh pits. I don't know if you've been in one lately.
No.
But when I was like you, man, when I, you know, when I was, you know, I'm the goth comedian, but I've been in some pits in my time, the punk shows and metal shows. And it used to be people just got in the pit and just started, you know, slamming into each other. Now, the pits are weird. I don't want to be like, well, I guess I am one of these old guys, but it's like, you know, back in my day, we just slammed each other. Lately, every pit I've been in, the safest place to be is stand right in the middle of the pit. You stand in the middle of the pit, nobody's even going to touch you. What they do is they go around and hit everybody outside that's not even in the pits.
That sucks.
Which is stupid. It's cool. Like, hit each other. That's what you're supposed to be there. I took my nephew to see Suicidal probably 10 years ago, and they were actually really good. Yeah. But the pits were like weird. It's like, well, there's like three or four guys sitting in the middle like this. I don't know what they're doing.
I hate that macho shit. Yeah.
My ex-girlfriend got elbowed in the face at a ministry show.
Oh, wow. That sucks.
And we're just standing there. And it's like, you know, it's like, hit each other, elbow each other in the face in the pit.
Yeah, man, it's not about bullying. I think what happened, the only time I've had bad experiences, you know, not to sound cliche, but it is kind of when people that were outside of the punk scene that were kind of like jocks or whatever, or, you know, or guys that were just had a bunch of testosterone, were like, hey, let's go hurt people, you know, and I was never like that. My friends were never like that. Like we fought back. But we didn't just attack people, you know. A lot of us, just like a lot of my comic friends, we're rescue animals, you know. And so for us, it was a release, but it was also a form of bonding, you know. Mm-hmm. A mosh pit. I made friends in mosh pits. There were guys that accidentally elbowed me in the face or hit me in the nose, and I had a bloody nose. But that same guy would you know, pick me up off the floor. Next thing you know, the two of us were drinking a beer together, and then I was friends with that guy for 15 years. You know what I mean? Like that's what that pit was. If you knocked someone down and it was you helped them up, it was about the energy of the pit. It wasn't about you trying to be a star and hurt people, you know.
Right. So I don't know what these kids are doing these days. I've actually just to test it out, stood in the middle of a pit and nobody touches me. Although
you're a big guy.
The other thing too is I'm usually the largest man in the pit. Sure. So yeah. People do try to knock me down, but that's it takes some doing. But the last time I saw you was at the Portland Comedy Festival, which you
won. That was a fun weekend. Yeah.
Oh, that was so much fun. And it was weird because I got there and I was on I did a really good set. And then I looked at the lineup. I was like, oh, Tamar's closing. And it's like whoever wins gets into the finals. I was like, well, Tamar's closing. Okay, I guess I'll try again tomorrow. But what was great about it was, I mean, the whole weekend was great. I met so many people and had so much fun and reconnected with some great people like you and Dante and other people that I haven't seen in a long time. But the last show where they had the 15 finalists go at it, that crowd was one of the best crowds I've seen in comedy. Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah. No, they were great. They were awesome. It's
at Harvey's Comedy Club in Portland.
Yeah. Harvey's is killer. And I love the club, the staff there, the management. It's a great club. And they really respect that. It's funny, you know, because it is a business. And there's a lot of clubs that are like, they put the business ahead of the art. And sometimes it suffers, you know. They want to make money. And sometimes to make a club a great club, you have to lose a little bit of money. You know, and that's what they do. I mean, they really care about comedy. They care about the quality of comedy. They care about the crowds. And if someone's, you know, doesn't follow the rules of comedy, they get them the fuck out of there, you know?
Right.
But it's a great club that really seems to respect the craft. And dude, like right after I won, they brought me up 2 weeks later. They had me headline a week there.
I
right
remember after. You did so good. The show that I was on that you were on, you did so good. Even before you won, they had booked you for the 2 weeks later.
Yeah, they were awesome. There was a headliner that like double booked or like made a mistake on his calendar. And so he had a weekend that he needed to fill. And it was actually, there was an open mic after the official, the festival had ended. And then they had like an open mic and I stayed just to try out some new material. And so the owner of the club was there. So it goes to show, you know, like sometimes people will be like, oh, I'd rather perform at the show, but not at the open mic, whatever. And open mics are cool, man. Like I don't care where I'm at. If it's, you never know when someone's going to see you. And if you love comedy, then it doesn't matter, you know, where you do it. It doesn't matter if it's a crowd of 150 people and they're two drinks in, or if it's 10 people and you find a way to make them laugh. Good comedy works, you know?
Yeah. No, I was, they were going to bring me back for Halloween.
Oh, that's rad.
But yeah, it was so close to Halloween that we couldn't quite do it. Cause they have Harvey's a comedy club in Portland. I don't know if you went on the tour, but they have underneath, they have tunnels.
Oh yeah. I heard about that.
Yeah. They have. And
I slept in that morning, man.
Where, yeah, it was, they gave us a tour, a bunch of comics, which was probably not a great idea. Cause it's a bunch of comics just, you know, goofing around. But, it was weird because like the Chinese immigrants would sleep in these tunnels.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was pretty creepy. And they had, it was weird. They had cells, they had beds. It was really, really creepy. So,
wow.
And then I saw him, he actually saw me in Las Vegas last year and we were trying to set something up and then COVID happened. But that last show, all the comics were good. I mean, all the comics in the festival were good, but that crowd, like every joke, even just the roar of the crowd, I'm like, wow, I haven't, I've performed and seen shows with larger crowds that weren't that loud.
Yeah, they were great.
And I had one of the people that was one of the runners up came up to me. I don't want to say their name, but they were like, you know, they were upset because they had such a killer set.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, you know, I hope you tape that set because that set's going to get you a lot of work.
Yeah.
And you know what? You had a great set, but you can't deny Tamara had a great set too. And he's like, you know what? You're right. And
oh, that's nice of you.
They did tape the set, and hopefully they've gotten a lot of work from it. He's a good comic. I won't name him, but yeah. When was the last time you were on stage in front of an audience?
Well, you know, I'm in Barcelona right now.
Right.
So last time I was on stage was,
last night.
Yeah. Last night. Yeah. I'm not getting up as often. I mean, there's loopholes right now for us. It's like we can do, with social distancing, there's not a big scene here. It's really, really small. But fortunately, before I came here to be with my lady, like I lived in London for 4 years. And when I started comedy, I performed comedy for like 4 years in London. So they know me in the UK and around Europe. But so when I got here, I had a Romanian friend named Victor Petroscan, who's a really good comic. And he was touring Europe when COVID started locking down. So now he's kind of been finding theaters and following all the rules, doing social distancing, and then like doing shows at those theaters. And I'm on shows that we actually produce ourselves. And so like there'll be a 200 person theater, and then through Facebook ads and stuff, we'll get like 80 people in with social distancing. They can't have booze. That's they cool. Gotta keep their masks on the whole time. We gotta put little condoms on the mic and spray disinfectant, but it's a real show, you know. It's so that's been really great. It's just not as often as I'd like it to be, but it's
right.
It's keeping me writing and it's keeping me getting on stage and it's keeping my sanity, you know.
No, I understand. I actually I did a show in Las Vegas, same thing, put a cover on the mic, sprayed it, and social distance, but
right on.
It's tough. It's I mean, in LA, it's LA shut down, but it's just it's a tough thing. And I, you know, like I said, Hannah really wanted a comedian. I was like, I don't have just any comedians on. Like last year I had like Stephen Pearl, Shang, Tom Dreesen.
That's great.
And I mean, this is the standard. First off, I want a comedian that has other things going on besides comedy. That's interesting.
Sure.
And then, I mean, those are like the top of the top, but I mean, especially, you know, Shang and Tom Dreesen, they're both like, I don't know what to do. this has been my life for so long. And yeah. They're kind of resisting the Zoom thing, but it sucks.
Yeah, it is. It's tough. But
tell me about England, because how long have you been doing comedy when you went to England?
Well, I've been doing comedy about 4 years at that point, but only like part-time. I still had my full-time job. And then I had a lot of friends in Europe, so they kept telling me about the Edinburgh Fringe in Scotland. They're like, come mm-hmm. do the Fringe in Scotland. I didn't know anything about it, you know, but I said, okay, I'll come and, you know, part of a trip, and I'll go pop up to Scotland with you guys, and, you know, I'll do a week. And I sent them a tape and all that stuff. They let me have a room that I shared with a British comic. And at the time, they also had like a competition, and right. and I ended up winning it. It was like best new international act or something. Right. And I ended up getting a manager out of it. And he told me if I wanted to come to England, that he'd give me an artist residency. A really shitty little place.
That's great.
But, you know, I wouldn't have to pay for rent for a year. So I came home, I sold my car, quit my job, packed up all my shit, put it all in storage, and moved to England. And it was a trip, dude. The apartment I lived in had no windows. And I shared it with another comic. And whenever we showered, we had to open a skylight, like one of the skylights on a van.
Oh, really?
Because if you didn't, the whole apartment would steam up.
Right.
It was wild. And then we were behind a chicken shop, and it was gated, so you couldn't see our front door. So because there was this weird wooden gate, people thought there was a dumpster behind our house. So it was a chicken shop, and then they thought it was right. a dumpster. So every time I'd come home, there'd be just four like plastic bags of chicken bones on my front door. And I'm like, God damn it, dude. Or I'd come home and there'd be like foxes, you know, or raccoons. And I'm like, this is the worst apartment ever.
Jeez, yeah. When you have foxes at your door, that's not good.
Yeah, man. There's foxes all over England. It's like a thing. Well, they're everywhere. But it was a good scene. I learned a lot being
I can imagine. Well, I mean, you're following in the footsteps of Bill Hicks, Dennis Leary, and other people that came
Patrice
out there.
O'Neill, too. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, Patrice O'Neill.
Just yeah, I learned a lot doing that.
You know, yeah, it's something that I never did, and I probably should have.
Yeah, you still can, you know.
I know. I mean, once COVID
England's
stops.
There. Yeah, for sure. I think once COVID stops, and I think people are always interested in hearing comics from other countries, especially us. I think people are always infinitely interested in the American perspective and what it's like. I think people look at us like we're a cult, you know, we're so different than you.
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine looking in from the outside, especially what's going on. But I saw on YouTube, you have a tape of you getting heckled by an Englishman, or I don't know if you started it or he started it, but you were pretty merciless.
Yeah, I don't fuck around with hecklers. It's funny because I don't take it personal. I just take it like, hey man, I do it like I'm protecting the show. It's not my pride. I'm doing it on behalf of everyone else in the room. I'm not doing it on behalf of my ego. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like I think because my energy comes from that place, it's really easy for the audience to stay on my side. So I don't, because everybody loves justice, but nobody likes over justice. You know, right. Nobody likes when it gets to be not fair. I don't ever want to be a bully myself. Well,
I don't know. So I've seen some heckle videos on YouTube. Some people do like that, but
yeah.
I mean, roast battles and everything else. It's like
sure.
It's sometimes, yeah. But yeah, I'm the same way with hecklers. Just you know, if I just want to get set everything. You want to set everything back to where it should be, but
yeah,
you know, it's I've warned people. I said you really don't want to go down this road.
Yeah, right. It's so crazy that people do stuff like that, but they don't know. I mean, sometimes they genuinely don't know, you know, sometimes they're just trying to be part of the show. And I usually give people a pass the first time, second time, you know, and then I'll explain it to them and be like, hey, you know what, you know, let's have this discussion after, because everyone's here for a show, whatever, you know, I try to be cool.
Yeah.
But then after that, then it's like, all right, the show's about you now. And you're not going to like it.
Yeah. But you have you always have the Zen energy, and you always have. Even when I first met you, you just have this calming energy. Because there's a lot of people, some comics that are just always on, And then you kind of, you just sort of always, always in a semi-meditative state. And if somebody comes up to you, then you engage with them. But you're not somebody that just like kind of goes, oh, hey, how you doing? And one of those guys, you know?
You know, I was pretty wild when I was a kid, and I used to have a pretty bad cocaine problem. And I think like cocaine, you know, burned a lot of my gas tank out. And I think well, before comedy, oh yeah, man. Like I think before comedy, I was just like this dude that I had a lot to say and I had a lot of opinions and I had stuff I wanted to express, but I didn't have an audience. So whenever my friends became my audience or strangers became an audience, you know, but once I found comedy, all of a sudden I was on stage every night. So then when we got to a party, I'm cool. I was full. You know what I mean? It's like I was full from comedy. It made me feel like good. So I could just go to a party and chill out and relax and have a good time and still engage with people for sure, but let other people have the stage, you know, in a way, and be able to sit back and listen and get jokes out of watching them tell bad jokes.
Right. But my experience has always been that the one who's always the loudest and talks the most usually has the worst set.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, especially if you're you know, dropping to an open mic or something and somebody's just really trying to off stage to prove something to you, it's like, just prove it on stage. And, you know, I mean, but so how did you get from punk rock to cocaine? How did that happen?
Yeah, you know, what did Robin Williams say? I think he said cocaine is God's way of letting you know you're making too much money. And, you know, I was a young guy. I was working at some of the best ad agencies in the world and making a lot of money. And I didn't have kids. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have anything. And I didn't have I didn't care about cars or anything like that, you know? So, you know, like I told one of my friends, like I was never addicted to drugs. I was addicted to not feeling sad. I was the very definition of a clown. Like whenever I was sad, my friends would just be like, what's wrong? Why aren't you being yourself? It wasn't like, what's wrong? Like, can I help you? It was, what's wrong? Why aren't you making us laugh? You know what I mean?
Right.
And I don't blame them. You know, it's kind of sweet in a way that it's nice to feel needed, but you know, it wasn't good for me because then I felt like I couldn't talk to anybody when I was down. And then, so coke would fix that problem for, you know, in 7 minute increments, you know? So I just kept having to take it all the time. And then at the time I was dating a girl that was a head bartender at Chateau Marmont, which is, you know, where many celebrities overdosed.
That's where Belushi overdosed. That's
exactly. And a lot of people don't know this, but if you're a head bartender at a fancy place in LA, usually drug dealers give you free samples because then the tourists will always ask bartenders, hey, where can I score? So my lady used to come home and bring, you know,
apparently Courtney Love and Steve Coogan had a 2 week bender there that they're still talking about.
That's so funny. I heard about that. Yeah.
Chateau Marmont is, yeah.
It's a crazy place.
Yeah. I don't know about now, but I don't know how they socially distance the coke now, but I'm sure they're. But I mean, geez, we've been going so long and I haven't even asked you about your love life, because you have a bit in your act where you talk about an ex-girlfriend, Michelle.
Yeah.
And you say, you talk about her by name.
Yeah.
First and last name.
Yeah.
Have you gotten blowback on that?
Yeah. Hey man, she's a bad person. You know, like, look, I don't do it in a, it's a joke, and the joke works better with her real name. And she was really horrible to me and owes me a lot of money. And so I figure I have a right to use whatever I want to use in that joke, and she doesn't have a right to complain. And so we had a conversation about it once, because I think she got approached by some people, and then she said, hey, can you not use my name? And I'm like, well, you kind of still owe me some money. Why don't you pay me back that money and I'll change the name?
So she hasn't paid me back. If she pays you money, then you'll change the name.
No, I lied. I probably would say keep the money.
And this is a woman you dated with one arm.
Well, she had two arms when we first started dating, but she had a really bad drinking problem. And she ended up getting in a really bad, she was drunk driving and she got in a bad accident, lost her arm. In the accident. Yeah, it was pretty heavy.
That's too bad. She still should pay you back.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, she's cool with it now. You know, that was, I mean, we were kids when that happened. And I think that there's a little bit of her that likes it. Like, even when she asked me, she's like, I can't believe you used my real name. She's smiling when she says it. Like, yeah. I think she gets a little kick out of it.
I'm sure she does.
Yeah.
And you seem to, I mean, just based on what I know about her, what little I know about her, the woman that your mother tried to set you up with, which on the show, which and your new wife, you like white women.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. It's not that I think my mom was just ready to set me up with anybody, but the girl she was trying to set me up.
Well, she seemed from Central Casting. Come on. That was.
Yeah. Actor. Yeah. I mean, she was the host of the show. My mom kept trying to set me up with her. And she, at the time, she was married to like an NFL player. So I'm like, oh my God, mom, please stop. But then, you know, when I was in college, I went to college in Sweden. Like my last year, I spent a semester abroad.
I know.
And I was. Yeah. And I spent a semester in Lund in Sweden. And so it was a trip because, you know, I was like, you learn a lot about sex and dating and women when you're in college. And so a big part of my development in between classes was in Sweden. And so I learned to kind of date the Swedish way more than the American way. And then when I got back from Sweden, I think I kind of had trouble in America, like kind of connecting. So I've always been attracted to Swedish women, not necessarily just because of the way they look, but because culturally I went from a boy to a man when I was in Sweden.
True. And what is dating the Swedish way?
Well, you know, it's like even in like the Nordic countries, you know, when you say stuff like, let's go Dutch, right?
Yeah.
Scandinavian culture is very 50-50. It's very equal, which is great. You know, that's mm-hmm. a very good thing. But sometimes that equality comes with a lack of romance. So like guys don't open doors. They don't take them out on like actual dates, you know, like oh, okay. I took a girl on a date in Sweden and they were like talking to all their friends about it. And it was like a big deal. You know, okay. Like normally in Sweden, if you want to meet up with a chick, you're like, hey, where are you and your friends going? And then you have to go and try to convince you and your friends right. to meet her and her friends. And a lot of times it's sex first. And, hey, well, if we had great sex, wow, well, now let's try to date, you know?
I like the Swedish.
Yeah. It's awesome. They're really good people. They're super open about sex and stuff. Like I remember I saw a Stallone movie there. It was Judge Dredd and it was rated X. So I was like, oh shit, Stallone's doing porn. But I saw the movie. It was a regular Judge Dredd movie. Yeah. And then 2 weeks later, I saw a Swedish movie. And it was rated PG. There were kids in the audience. And a dude pulled down his pants and pulled his dick out. And I'm talking, this is like 15 right. years ago, 20 years ago.
Right.
And my friends started laughing at me. They're like, oh, yeah, you're American. And I'm like, what does that mean? And they're like, oh, you guys rate your movies by sex. We rate our movies by violence.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, my God, that makes so much more sense. You know, like they just made so much more sense. So it changed my brain a little bit. And I really kind of embraced their perspective on the world. And so when I met my current lady, I mean, I definitely don't have a preference. I've dated black women. I've dated Latinas, but you know, this was more of like a personality and a cultural fit. I mean, my lady's like my wife now, Anna, she's Swedish, but she's also a big traveler. I mean, she worked as a stylist in Pakistan and as red-haired, blue-eyed Swede, you know, and yeah. Now she's a life coach and does all kinds of different stuff, but she's a big traveler and, you know, she's from Sweden, lives in Spain.
That's great.
So, yeah.
And we're going to get to her in just a second, and we're going to,
sure.
I want to hear all about her, and then we'll, but you have, I don't know if it was a bit or you were on the show, but you were bemoaning coffee dates.
Oh, was
I? I want to pick with you on that one.
Okay.
I like the coffee dates. Especially yeah. with people meeting online now. It's the pre-date yeah. before the date.
Yeah, I don't mind coffee dates anymore. My opinion's changed. I think maybe, I don't remember what it was I said exactly, but like.
It was like something about guys don't do coffee dates.
Oh, yeah.
Just rattling off a bunch of things that guys shouldn't do. And
oh, yeah, yeah. I think that was.
Might be on
was
your album. Hosting. I'm not sure.
No, it was, I was hosting a thing for like a company. And I was like a news desk piece. I was doing, and I was okay. like, take him out on a real date. That's what I was talking about.
Right. Yeah. No, because I've found success with the coffee or coffee, sure. or coffee or drinks, and then you have the real dates.
You know what it is, dude? I love things that take risk. Mm-hmm. And I think going out on a real date is a risk. Like if I'm too nervous, and there's nothing wrong with coffee, don't get me wrong. But for me, I like there being an element of danger. if I'm not turned on enough that I'm willing to take the risk of dinner, then I shouldn't be going out with that girl anyway. You know what I mean? There were times in my life where I just was dating to date.
Right.
And I didn't need to waste my time like that. So then I just decided if I'm going to go on a date, it's going to be a date that I'm convinced I want to take to dinner, where I'm willing to take that risk.
Okay.
But coffee's cool too. You know, it was just me. I like a little bit of a risk.
No, I know. I've been on dinner dates where it was like, around the salad, you're like, I really want to go, but you gotta stick it out. And then the other thing about coffee dates is I don't drink coffee. So that's always a good conversational piece. Although I did have a woman tell me, she questioned my manhood because I ordered a chai latte, but that's a whole different
story. Jesus. Well, you know what's cool, dude, is if you do have a date that goes sour after the fucking appetizers, the rest of it is just material for your, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well. It's cool to be, I don't mind being uncomfortable. Like it's kind of cool to be, it's good to get out of your comfort zone sometimes or hang out with people that you normally wouldn't hang out with. Or so I, even when I've been on dates where the date went real bad, I kind of try to hang in there and like, try to like, just be curious about the person, you know?
Right. No, the worst date I ever was on, she got in the car. I picked her up in North Hollywood and she was beautiful. She actually, red hair, blue eyes, totally my type. And she gets in the car. She's like, so you're a comedian, huh? I'm like, yeah. She's like, do you know any N-word jokes?
Whoa.
Interesting question, because honestly, I know some, I don't tell them. And then we went to see this band it was this long time ago in Silver Lake in Spaceland. And
oh wow, I remember Spaceland.
Yeah, so I finally got the conversation off overt racism and on other things. And then she's like, I'm gonna go to the bathroom. And she went to the bathroom, never came back.
Whoa.
She like snuck around me and had a friend pick her up.
Wow.
That's not a good date. Yeah.
Yeah. And too, she's weak, dude. There's nothing where, like, a lot of women will talk about, like, or they want a strong man. I want a strong woman.
Yeah.
I don't like weak people like that. That's whack.
But yeah, I should have just screeched the brakes when she started with the N-word jokes. But
yeah, there you go. I mean, she's a weak person. Like, you know, usually people that are super racist are super weak, you know, so she's probably
insecure at the least. But here's the interesting, there's a lot of interesting things, and you have you're starting a YouTube channel with your wife, who apparently is as much a ham as your mother is. So there's something there. And I want to get to what your mother thinks of everything that's happened, but you met her on Bumble.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, I was on Bumble for over 2 years. By the way, Bumble is where the woman makes the first move.
Yeah.
The woman sends the first message.
I was like on Bumble
for 2 years, never got a message.
Well, you know what's funny, dude? I've been on Bumble too for a while, and I didn't really dig it, but I was in New York. It was quarantine. We were in a heavy lockdown at the time, and Bumble had this thing called Passport, where you could, you know, check out girls in other countries and like be in other countries. And when I was a kid and we didn't have that much money and I wanted to travel, I would kind of just go on the internet and like look at pictures of the places I wanted to travel to, or look at videos and stuff. And it was my way of traveling to places, you know,
right,
like in my head. And so that's kind of what I was doing with this Bumble Passport, but I didn't think I would click with someone the way I clicked with her. And so it was crazy, you know, that we just met on Bumble. And the day I started talking to her, like, we just spoke every day. And
what was her first message to you?
I think it was she's actually embarrassed by it, because she knew I was a comic, and then I was like, oh, she's really hot, but she's got this, she's got a Mel Brooks tattoo on her forearm. Right. So she's a hardcore comedy fan, and the Swedish comedy scene is strong. And she's from a town in particular that's like got a really strong scene in southern Sweden called Malmo. Mm-hmm.
Right.
She's like a 20-minute train ride over the bridge to Copenhagen, and that's another really strong European comedy scene. So she's kind of a comedy snob. And she's like, well, this is awkward. She's like, because I think you're great. You seem cool. I'm interested in getting to know you. She's like, but now that I know you're a comic, this is dangerous, because what if we start talking and then I look up your comedy and I think you're shit? So I was like, yeah, that's a danger. That's a risk you're going to have to take. And I was like, yeah, whatever. You want to look up my comedy, look up my comedy. I don't care.
Right. And little did she know that you won the World Series of Comedy. You won the World Comedy Festival, Portland Comedy Festival, all these. I mean, you just enter a contest, you automatically win for some reason.
No, I don't know about that. I mean, there's plenty. I mean, dude, there's still festivals that where they just go, no thanks.
For the Big Pine, you won that too?
Yeah. But I mean, there's plenty of festivals that still don't let me in, you know. I mean, yeah. I've submitted to festivals and yeah, it happens. But you know, comedy's subjective and that's cool. I don't take it personally anymore. I mean, I used to, but I don't take it personally anymore. And then you know, we just started talking. I think because it was COVID and because I had so much time just to sit and reflect and just be in this tiny apartment. I was living in the Lower East Side. Wow. In New York, my apartment was small, dude. And it was like a real lockdown in New York. It was heavy. Yeah. And nobody was on the subway. So if the subways aren't running, people weren't really traveling, you know. In California, we had our cars, but in New York, so I was like really locked down. So when we talked, I was just super honest with her because I didn't think. I'm like, what's the point of lying? It's not like she's across the street. I'm not trying to get laid. I'm just talking. You know, so when she asked me, I was just brutally honest. And then it's like, it's almost like I like being a dancer where you lead and they follow. But she kind of led with the honesty. And then I followed and was like super duper honest and unnaturally honest, I'd say, you know, and then it kind of got fun where we started like almost challenging each other with asking more and more personal questions. And all of a sudden, after doing that for a month and a half or so, I felt like so close to her. And we went from phone to FaceTime. And then from FaceTime, I was like, I gotta go meet this girl. And I did research. I already had COVID in March and I had a test, you know, a piece of paper that said I had the antibodies and everything from the hospital. So there were laws that said I could go to Spain. So I got my plane ticket and I was going to go to Barcelona. And then while I was in the air, they changed the law and I landed in Barcelona and they said, you can't come in at the border. So they stopped me at the border. Yeah, man, she was 500 feet away from me and they took me straight to a police station, took my passport, searched through all my shit, you know, thank God I didn't bring anything, you know? Right. And they put me in jail, kept my passport. The next morning they gave me a lawyer and a translator, told me about my rights. And then they wouldn't return my passport. They walked me onto the plane after the plane was already full, like Hannibal Lecter, dude. Like I was escorted on by cops. Wow. And then they gave my passport to the airline attendants and said, you could give this to him in London. And then even in London, they wouldn't give me my passport because they said London was totally locked down. Even the hotels were all closed. So I had to sit in a chair in the airport for 18 hours after flying to Spain and now flying back. It was brutal. And, you know, the whole time, you know, she's on, you know, not knowing what's going on and all this stuff. And so then I got back to America and lost all the money on the plane ticket. And I started doing research. I found Gibraltar, and Gibraltar was sort of this weird anomaly. It's on Spanish land, but it's owned by Britain. And it's not part of the EU. And in the EU, if you know, they have like unified laws. So all of the EU was keeping Americans out, but Gibraltar wasn't. Gibraltar was like, we have no COVID deaths. We have really good tracing. Americans can come in here. So we made a deal to meet there. But dude, every day we were watching the news. And yeah, if, you know, if the stuff would go up, we're like, we're not going to be able to meet. We didn't know if we'd ever be able to meet, but we made it. She flew to Malaga. And then got in the car and drove 2 hours and I flew into Gibraltar and then we met there and we were supposed to be in Gibraltar for 2 days and get married. And then when we got married, I'd be able to get into Spain, like as the husband, a family member of a remote EU citizen is what they called it. And dude, COVID even fucked with FedEx because I just needed my birth certificate. I needed my original birth certificate, and she needed a different kind of birth certificate from Sweden. Mm-hmm. And both of our birth certificates got delayed. So instead of going to Gibraltar, getting married, and 3 days later going back to Barcelona, we got to Gibraltar and stayed there for 2 weeks, like going from Airbnb to Airbnb to hotel, and just like never knowing if it was ever going to happen, you know?
Well, tell us about the first time you saw her in person.
Oh, dude, it was wild. It was kind of confusing because, so we had PTSD, you know, from last time she was waiting at an airport for me in Barcelona. Now she's in the airport in Gibraltar. And they exited from the back of the plane and I was in the last row. So I messaged her. I'm like, oh shit, they're exiting from the back of the plane. I think I'm in the front of the line. So I was about five people back from the front and they started just taking everybody's passport. Not a single American on the plane. It was just pretty much Europeans. And then there was a small group of dudes that were all like Pakistani and Bangladeshi that were there to work on boats. They were like seamen, right? And no joke, one person before me, they go, wait, EU people here, non-EU and seamen over there. So by the time they said that, all the ship guys ran to the other line. And I went from being in the front of the line to being like 30th back.
So all the seamen in your way.
Yeah, man. So then I messaged her and I'm like, hey, so I'm not in the front of the line after all. And she's like, are you fucking with me? Did they stop you again? And I'm like, no, I swear it's cool. But for that 20 minutes, she was freaked out, you know?
I can imagine.
And then when I came through the airport, it was like one-way glass. So she couldn't see me. And I could see her. And like for a second, I just paused and looked at her and went, oh shit, that's her. Because that was the first time I'd seen her in real life, you know?
Yeah.
And then I went through this sort of turnstile door, SAR, and we just immediately, in my brain, I was like, what am I going to do? Do I just grab her? Do I hug her first? Do I kiss her? What do I do? And dude, as soon as I went through the turnstile, she just grabbed me and we started making out.
Very nice.
Yeah, it was rad.
Very,
it was great.
Very romantic.
Yeah, it was great.
Now, what does your mother think of this this marriage? It seems all of a sudden, I know she's always wanted to have you married, but
yeah,
this seems very quick.
Well, she knows me, you know, and it was very quick. And, but she knows me and she knows, like, she was a risk taker too. You know, she was a Jewish girl that married a Muslim dude. And I think, you know, she did something where everybody thought she was crazy and she thought it wasn't, you know, and everybody told her like, it's not going to work. And so I think that, she's an open-minded person. And she saw how different I was. And I talked to my mom too, you know what I mean? Like I have mm-hmm. a really close relationship with her. So it's not like it was so out of the blue for her. It was fast for sure. But you know, she knows I was 49 when all this went down. Right. So my mom's like, fuck dude, get married already. You know, I think maybe if I was 29, she'd be like, slow down. Yeah. Now she's like, fucking do it, dude. Yeah.
We just grandchildren. She's okay with that.
We'll dude, and here's the crazy thing. Anna's mom and my mom are like super buddies on social media. It's crazy. Okay. And they don't even share a language. So they're both like communicating to each other in broken English. And my mom's trying to understand Swedish, you know, and they're like just being friends and sending each other nice messages with emojis and like broken English and stuff. But it's really cute. Like they really hit it off.
and how long have you been married?
5 months now. I've been here for five months. So we've kind of been like, we parked in Barcelona and just said, you know, let's wait a little bit till it's not like I can make any money when I get back to America anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm trying to do what I can to make money. You know, I'm on this little cartoon in the UK. And so I'm trying to do that. But that only lasted like a couple episodes. So now we're just, you know, we're here until we figure out what to do next and where we're going to go, but we're sort of on pause, but just, you know, digging it so far.
And having a lot of romantic sex, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So doing a YouTube channel now.
I mean, yeah, we're YouTube stoked channel, about
you
that.
You have a YouTube show with the two of you.
Yeah.
Super cute. What is it called again?
It's called Nice to Marry You. Cause I asked her to marry me the day we met. So it was like, I married her and then started to get to know her. So Nice to Marry You is the name of it. And it's cool. It's like the first time I've kind of embraced the YouTube stuff. Like I didn't before. I was like, there's comics and then there's YouTubers. And I'm like, right. They've been stealing stage time from us. it's time for us to steal YouTube time from them.
Sure.
So I started, you know, working on doing a lot of research on YouTube and stuff. And I felt like we had a good story to tell. And I feel like when I was a comic, I get on stage when, I mean, you know, before
way
COVID,
back when in the 2020s.
You know, yeah. Before COVID, yeah. Like comedy rewards you for being really honest. And I just felt like we had a really kind of a unique relationship in the sense that I'm really uncomfortably honest with her. And with comedy, I realized audiences loved when I was uncomfortably honest with them about my life. Right. So why not audiences over YouTube? And I mean, the episode that's coming next is super uncomfortable for me, you know? And it's like, I'm talking about, like when the cops arrested me, I cried. And I'm not comfortable with that, you know, and she FaceTimed me and I didn't know if I should pick up or not, cause I didn't want her to see me fucking crying, you know? And, it was funny moments too. Cause the cops, when they're searching through my bag, they pulled out like headgear and like a mouth guard and my boxing gloves. They're like, oh, are you a boxer? And I look over at them, I'm crying. I'm like, yes, I'm a boxer. So, and we had this conversation where I'm like, I was really uncomfortable. I wasn't going to answer because I thought you'd think less of me, you know, for crying. And she's like, what? She's like, that's stupid. I go, I know it's stupid. I know you say it's stupid. I go, but I feel weak when I cry. And for you to see me cry before you even met me is heavy for me. So we're doing stuff like that where we're talking about real shit. There was a time where she fixed a sink that I couldn't fix. And it's, you know, so we're having like, you know, we're talking about real shit and shit that makes, if it makes us uncomfortable, we're going to talk about it.
Well, I got to tell you, since you're newlywed, get ready to cry some more. She'll make you cry a few times. I'm sure.
But, yeah.
Tamara, this has been great. We could talk forever. And this
thanks,
is,
man. Thanks
by the way, this
me.
Is why you're a great comic and you, and
so are you, man.
Oh, I appreciate it. This is why you dominate on stage is because, or why I like it. And I don't see enough younger comics like this, but you really put your life out there.
Oh,
and
thanks, man.
You know, not everybody's half Egyptian, half Jewish, but we can all relate to it. So
yeah.
I would just, you have a unique story and you tell it. And thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having
you,
me.
Anytime. Hopefully you come back and hopefully we'll have a whole thing, but
sure. It's good to see you.
Yeah. You know, I won't wait for you two to get divorced, so I'll have you guys on. Not that you're going to, of course, but
no, I think we're going to make it.
Yeah, I think when we have the Tamara Jr. and the whole gang, we'll get I'm gonna have your mom on next week, but Tamara, tell everybody where they can find you and your website and you know, and where you can find the YouTube show. Hopefully, I hope it goes viral.
Thanks, bro. Me too. So far, it's going great. We just put up the trailer. So if people can follow us on YouTube, if you just look up Tamara Catan and subscribe to my YouTube channel, it's called Nice to Marry You. Or just Tamara Catan. It's TamaraKatan. On Instagram, Tamara Cat is a good place. Also, like I keep people posted on what I'm doing there. And those are the two best places. I have my website as well that lists shows when shows start happening again. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, Instagram and YouTube are the best place.
And by the way, does your wife know that you were in a movie called Pervs?
She does. Yeah, man. It was one of the first things she saw.
Well, when you go to the IMDb, it comes right up. And I was like, I know everybody in that movie. So I haven't seen it. I got to check it out.
Yeah,
Felicia did it. I never even knew about it.
Yeah, man. It was a really great documentary. It was really great.
On comedy pervs.
No, actually on a female comedian who was a sex worker.
Ah.
And she was talking about being a sex worker and being a comic, but really just wanted to be a comic and how, what people thought of her and how it affected her and stuff like that. It was really honest and real. And some of the feedback that they got during the interviews, there's definitely some surprising turns in the documentary about things that a lot of the comics went through in their lives. It was really honest and raw and great.
Sounds cool.
It was beautiful. I loved it.
Anyway, Tamara, you give everybody hope. There is love.
Oh, thanks, dude.
Even
really
in the
nice.
Age of COVID.
Yeah, man.
And everybody go to Goth Comedian on all social media and have a wonderfully creepy week. Bye.
Dude, thanks for having me. It was